I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
There's a part in my book where I say she taught me how to write, and she raged against the author I became, and she taught me to be free, and then she raged against my freedom.
In this holiday special, we speak to the acclaimed Indian writer Arundhati Roy about her new memoir, Mother Mary Comes to Me. The book focuses on her mother, Mary Roy, and how Arundhati was shaped by her, both as a source of terror and inspiration. We'll also talk to Arundhati Roy about Gaza and the rise of authoritarianism from India to the United States. Then we remember Bill Moyers, the legendary PBS broadcaster, former White House aide, who died in June at the age of 91.
The consensual seduction of the mainstream media by and with the government is one of the most dangerous toxins at work in America today.
All that and more coming up. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In this Democracy Now! Special, we're joined by one of the world's most acclaimed writers, Arundhati Roy, author of many books, including the novels The God of Small Things and The Ministry of Utmost Happiness. Roy has been a frequent guest on Democracy Now! For over two decades, talking about her novels as well as her nonfiction work and her activism. She's been a vocal critic of U.S. foreign policy from the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq to the U.S. arming of Israel. In India, she's been repeatedly targeted by authorities for criticizing Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his far-right ruling BJP party. In August, authorities in Indian-occupied Kashmir banned a list of books, including her collection of essays titled Azadi, Freedom, Fascism, Fiction. Earlier this year, Arundhati Roy published her new memoir, Mother Mary Comes to Me. The critically acclaimed book focuses on her mother, the celebrated educator Mary Roy, and how Arundhati was shaped by her, both as a source of terror and of inspiration. The Times writes, quote, "In this unsparing yet darkly funny memoir, the prize-winning novelist captures the fierce, asthmatic, impossible, inspirational woman who shaped her as a writer and an activist and left her emotionally bruised for a lifetime," unquote. In September, Democracy Now!'s Nermeen Sheikh and I spoke to Arundhati Roy. We began the interview by asking her about the title of her book, which is based on the lyrics of the Beatles song, Let It Be.
The title, I think it chose me, the Beatles play a big part in the book. Somehow, even though it was a little after I was a little late for them, but I loved that music, and it gave me the sort of steel in my spine and the smile on my face to leave home, which I did when I was 18 for a whole host of reasons, but I did listen to She's Leaving Home on a loop, you know, weeks before I left. And of course, it was interesting because the book was launched in Cochin in St. Teresa's Girls' College, and the hall by chance was called Mother Mary Hall. Then my brother sang Let It Be, and I said, well, there are three Mother Marys here. One is the Virgin Mary, one is Paul McCartney's mother, and the third is ours, and they are all very different,
So your first book, God of Small Things, is also dedicated to your mother. You wrote, "She loved me enough to let me go," which your brother joked was the only bit of real fiction in the book.
Yes. Well, when I wrote The God of Small Things, you know, I had, of course, left home and lived as a adult for many years. I put myself through architecture school, working and all that. And there was years of estrangement. She never asked why I left or what happened or anything. She didn't need to because we both knew. And I was aware that, she was still the principal of a school she founded in this small town. And for her to have a daughter leaving would have been something.
At the age of 16.
Yes, and it was a very complicated thing, the God of Small Things too, coming out in that town. So I said, we settled on a lie, a good one, which I crafted. And I said, she loved me enough to let me go, which my brother's jokes was the only piece of real fiction in the book. But it was just, all my life, I had to sort of manage this relationship with a woman who was amazing and also very, very dark, And so, as I said, in order for her to shine her light on her students and generations of them to challenge a law which eventually she won, and Christian women won equal inheritance rights.
About that for a minute, and then we'll go into the internal, deeper, darker place. But what she was to India and to women.
So she, she came from a very small community of people who live in Kerala called the Syrian Christians. Very, I won't say elite, but, a very protected, somewhat elite, landowning, more for the most part, people. Very conservative, very parochial. And then she married outside of the community, my father, and then got divorced and came back. And she had no money and nowhere to go, and she was living in a little cottage outside of Kerala, which belonged to her rather cruel father who had died by then. And her mother and brother, we were little, I was three and my brother was four, and her mother and brother came and tried to evict us by saying that according to the Travancore Christian Succession Act, women could inherit a fourth of what a son could, or 5,000 rupees, which is, at that time, a little bit of money. But whichever is less, in effect, couldn't inherit. So she, she nurtured this mortification, and she waited for, she started, once she came out of this poverty, she started a little school, and it became a huge success. It is a huge success. And when she had the means, she challenged the law and said it was unconstitutional. And eventually it was struck down by the Supreme Court, and women, Christian women, were given equal inheritance rights. So it was revolutionary, but so was her school. And so is her school, a really amazing place, So I was always able to see this public figure who was extraordinary. And, there was some other story going on in private.
I mean, there's several incidents in the book. I'll go back to the things that you said earlier about your decision to leave home when you did. But your mother's extremely strong personality, her courage. She was a radical feminist, bold and uncompromising in perhaps all aspects of her life. If you could give us a couple of examples of that from the book. But then you write that the way that your mother treated your brother has, quote, queered and complicated, this is you writing, queered and complicated my view of feminism forever, filled it with caveats. So if you could explain that for us, a couple of examples, and then what happened.
So, when people label her like a radical feminist or something, those labels don't sit well with her or me, because she was so eccentric and so non-righteous about what she did, and she was such a wild character. So I wouldn't, use those words to describe her, but yes, she was an iconic person in feminist circles, especially because of the case that she won, less so because of the school, because fewer people know about the school, but to me it's as revolutionary. And when we lived in this little town where there was so much conservativeness and all kinds of passive and active violence against women. And she would just go into courtrooms, to hospitals, to places where she had heard, you know, women had been beaten up or raped or whatever. And she would try and tell them, look, there's an option. You don't have to be like this, you know. So it was a wonder to watch that. But at the same time, she had left my father because he was addicted to alcohol. I didn't know my father ever, and until I was about 25. And she was hard on both of us, but especially on my brother. And so there's a part in the book where my brother was a little older than me, so he suffered the pain of losing his father or of having this crazy, violent single parent, you know. And from being a really wonderful, excellent student, he just began to drop in his grades. And we were sent away to another school because her school did not have classes up to, you know, class 6 and 7 and so on. So we were sent away. And there's an incident where one night our report cards came and we were both awake, and she came and took him at night to her room, and I followed and looked through the keyhole, and I saw her just beating him till the thing broke, and sort of shouting in a whisper, because the school was also, our home was also the hostel for little children, and saying, no son of mine can come with a report that says average student. And then in the morning he came back to bed, and we both knew we were awake, but in the morning she came and hugged me and said, you have a brilliant report. And I just felt like, I just hated myself, and I felt like, even now I feel, you know, that if ever I'm sort of celebrated, there's someone quiet being beaten in the other room. And that, from being a very personal thing, has also become a very political thing. And I know that as my book comes out, what is going on in Gaza, you know, children are being starved, hospitals are being bombed, a whole genocide is taking place in public light. And we have to continue to do our work, always cognizant of the fact that it's not just one thing that's happening to you. You know, many things are happening, and the quiet person is being beaten. Yes.
I mean, one could say that, in fact, you've dedicated your life as a result to being with those who are being beaten, or at least standing in solidarity with them.
Yeah, I mean, dedicated sounds a little pious, but for me, I think what happens is that once you've been unsafe in that safest place, I suppose the safest place is the mother, and once that is unsafe, safety is very hard to find again, and you're constantly aware of the unsafe, you know, constantly aware of that other thing that's happening, and unable to sort of settle into safety in some way.
And yet, the way you describe how she beat your brother and then congratulated you, it is not as if you were the favored child. I mean, after your mom passed away a few years ago and you were so wrecked by it, your brother said to you, she treated nobody as badly as she treated you. Talk about your relationship with your mother.
Well, both of us believed that of each other. You know, I think that she treated him worse, and he thinks she treated me worse. But the relationship was, you know, what happened was, to me, I could see it almost like a chemical experiment, you know, like a chemical reaction, because she had left her husband. She was living in this conservative community. She was being humiliated. She was being evicted. She was being, you know, whispered about. And all the anger that accumulated, the only safe harbor she had to unload it on was me and my brother, you know. And it's such a patriarchal community. So they used to call us in Malayalam, address illatha pillare, meaning the children with no address, because we didn't have a home as such, you know. a parental place. And with me, I came along at a time when her relationship with her husband was already over. So she didn't want another child. And I mean, now as an adult, I can understand it. But
and she made it clear.
Yeah, she kept saying, I wish I had dumped you in an orphanage and all this.
Or that she had had an abortion.
Yes. And then at the same time, she also reinforced me by, because it was made clear to me that I'm on the edge of this community, not at the bottom, but on the edge, and its reassurances were not for me, the arranged weddings and the protections and the whatever. So she knew that I had to go, like I could not be there, and she, in some ways, she prepared me, but sometimes it was harsh. Like she just kept telling me I'm going to die, and because she was a very, very severe asthmatic, and so there was this constant thing of any moment I'm going to die, and I was like her spare lung. I was like breathing for her, and saying I'll breathe for you. And then as I grew up, that sort of dependency obviously began to change, and it, for her, it was a hostile thing, And so, of course, like there's a part in my book where I say she taught me how to write, and she raged against the author I became, and she taught me to be free, and then she raged against my freedom. But she did put that steel in my spine, and she did teach me something in harsh ways, which did help me survive, on my own in a city, from Kerala to Delhi. It's like 3 days and two nights by train, and you don't speak Hindi, and you don't know what's going on. But at the same time, there was that sense of, I'm just looking for a better life. I'm not looking to suffer here. I'm looking for some joy. I'm looking for some happiness. I'm looking for something great to happen, not as in ambitious, but, surely things are going to be better. That's why I left. And I say that in the book, not because I didn't love her, but in order to be able to continue to love her. To me, the book was a writing challenge. Can I share with people a person that you simply cannot make up your mind about, Because there are so many wonderful things and then terrible things and then wonderful things, and it just keeps turning over and over. I keep saying she's like an airport with no runways, like you could never land your plane. And also, there are so many people who are people of, who have a calling, whether they are musicians or whether they are politicians or whether they are poets, or so many people whose primary concern may not have been their own children, But in my case, my mother's calling was other people's children, which was what made it a bit complicated for us. Why we had to call her Mrs. Roy, because we were just students in her school and so on. But yeah, it was continuously that process of being gifted something and then being shredded, and then but learning to hold on to those gifts, and not let them smash along with the shredding.
You not only called her Mrs. Roy in public because she didn't want you to seem favored, and you felt that maybe she was harsher on you and your brother so that you wouldn't seem favored, but you also called her Mrs. Roy privately.
But we didn't have any private, because what happened was that she started a school initially in the rented halls of the Kottayam Rotary Club. We had to go with brooms every day and sweep up all the men's cigarette stubs and wash all their glasses and put them away, put down these little tables, and that was the school. And then when the school started doing better, she rented a little house nearby and started a hostel. So there was no home as such. I never actually, in my entire life with her, never lived in a home because it was always the school. There was no private. I left home and many years later came back, and then she had built herself a home, which was not my home, So there was no private. We did have to just private was public, and all this anger and humiliation therefore happened in public. You know, that was the problem. It wasn't behind closed doors.
So, I mean, you said, and this is, of course, you say it in the book, that you left home not because you didn't love your mother, but so that you could continue to love her. And I don't know, the book itself, it seems, I mean, the writing of it, and again, this is my reading, the writing of it, the recounting of it, is a means of both relinquishing something of your relationship to her while also maintaining the greatest intimacy with certain aspects of her. Because this split, and it is a split because it goes from one extreme to another, wouldn't necessarily result in a book that is so close to her. Not only in dialogue, but I don't know, there's something in the book. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting, I think, that, you know, I was thinking all of it happened instinctively, but the release of the book in Cochin, taking all my publishers from New York and London and everywhere who had come to Kerala to the school. There was my brother sharing the stage with me, even though, you know, we had very different like he has a different anger towards her. Mine is so ambiguous and his is clearer, more settled in some ways. And I was thinking, why did I do it, you know? And I think it was because it's not just for me. All this was hidden in plain sight. Like everybody knew what was going on, but it wasn't spoken about. And somehow it just felt like everybody just felt, okay, it's okay, you know, we can all celebrate her, but we don't have to pretend that what happened didn't happen. And I actually called the teachers in the school before the book came out. I said, you know, there's a difference between hagiography and literature. Coming soon to a theater near you is literature. And it isn't going to diminish her or the school at all, but I just feel that the world also needs to know about this complex woman and the fact that you don't have to be... I mean, there's so much pressure on women to be perfect mothers, perfect daughters, perfectly obedient, perfectly nice, perfectly... You know, my mother was just unvarnishedly her. And that, I think, is a relief for many women, you know?
Talk about writing this book after your mother died. And you don't like to use the word abuse, though clearly today it would be seen very much in those terms. Your brother would certainly use that term. And what you most learned about yourself and your relationship as you talk about two women also most of your life with your mother. She died at the age of 89, even though she was a severe asthmatic. Most of your life, the two of you were women.
I didn't learn, honestly, I mean, like I didn't learn anything about myself or about this relationship in the process of writing the book, because I already knew, I had already lived with it, talked about it from the time I was 3 years old. I had had to be this person who disassociated from myself. Like I think I said in some interview, one half of me was taking the hits and the love and the instructions, and one half was taking notes. And so it's not that I set out to learn something or that it was therapeutic for me to write this book, nothing like that. But it was somehow, it was a challenge to the craft of writing. Like, can I do this? You know, can I try to share her with people in all her various aspects, because that was what she was, this incredibly unmediated person, you know. And I don't use those words only because they may be true or not true, but, you know, they quickly label someone and flatten everything into some sort of acceptable language, and then we all sort of try to fit into that language, whereas for me, language is something very, very, very important, you know?
Arundhati Roy, author of the new memoir, Mother Mary Comes to Me. Coming up, Arundhati will read from her book and talk about the rise of authoritarianism from India to the United States and more.
Oh, pretty fair miss out in the garden. Stranger man came riding by.
Now, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. In this holiday special, we're continuing our conversation with Arundhati Roy, author of the new memoir, Mother Mary Comes to Me. I interviewed her in September with Democracy Now!'s Nermeen Sheikh.
I mean, you write in the first few pages of the book, and this captures a little bit of the ambivalence as well as this conversation, I think. You write, quote, "Perhaps what I'm about to write is a betrayal of my younger self by the person I have become. If so, it's no small sin, but I'm in no position to be the judge of that." So did you mean, well, why don't you just explain what precisely you meant by that and, you know, what people can learn from it?
Well, what I meant was that, you know, to leave home at the age of 16, 17, 18, I mean, it was like in stages, and 18 was the final goodbye, you know, but obviously, you know, it wasn't, I mean, obviously at that time, I wasn't the person that I am now, who hasn't broken or ended up in prison or, you know, on drugs or something, and so all those risks were there when I left, you know. And so for me, perhaps there's a sort of calmer person remembering that jagged younger person, you know. So I don't know whether I'm betraying that jagged younger person because I landed on my feet. And what would this book have been had I not, you know?
Mm-hmm. I'd like you to read something from your book, Mother Mary Comes to Me. We're talking to Arundhati Roy, the great writer, the activist. Her new book, Mother Mary Comes to Me, is just out. It is a memoir.
Often people ask me about, like you just did, you know, about the therapeutic process or whether there was one while I was writing this. But for me, it was really, you know, all these things that were happening to me and the fact that we all live in this multilingual world. My father's from Bengal. My mother's from Kerala. I'm born in Shillong. I studied in Delhi and Tamil Nadu for a while. So language was like, how do you describe this multilingual world? Not for any reason of writing a great book, but just for speaking to yourself about what was happening to you, you know? So I want to just read a little bit about my search for language, because to me, that search was what resulted in everything I wrote plus this book. So all through school, I did consistently badly in English, language and literature. I never understood the rules. Mrs. Roy would slash through my essays and compositions, mark me 3 out of 10, and write comments like horrible, nonsense. And she was right. They were complete and utter rubbish. Even then, I knew that the language I wrote in was not mine. And by mine, I don't mean mother tongue. And by language, I don't mean English, Hindi, or Malayalam. I mean a writer's language. Language that I used, not language that used me. A language in which I could describe my multilingual world to myself. I knew even then that language was outside me, not inside me. It would not come to me on its own. I needed to hunt it down like prey, disembowel it, eat it. And when I did, I knew that language, my language, would ease the way blood flowed through my body. It was out there somewhere, a live language animal, a striped and spotted thing, grazing, waiting for me, the predator. That was the law of my jungle. It wasn't a nonviolent vegetarian dream.
That's beautiful.